The Monsters That Made Us is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things movies, music, media, monsters, and more, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. Today we head back to the sandy kingdom of Acadia, where a young Matthias is on a quest to avenge the death of his father at the hands of the evil King Sargon, a quest that will take him across the Mediterranean Sea and deep into the underworld as he seeks the fabled Sword of Damocles, which is said to have the power to kill anything, mortal or immortal. Along his journey, he and his companions will have to defeat minotaurs, goddesses, and yes, a giant invisible scorpion, so that Matthias can get his vengeance and become the new Scorpion King of Acadia. Get yourself some boat tickets, and don't worry about the insurance, it's a scam, and join us as we discuss The Scorpion King 2, Rise of a Warrior.
To a new world of gods and monsters.
Listen to them. Children of the night.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
You're crazy to know who I am, aren't you? I'll show you who I am and what I am!
You're insane. I tell you, I killed a wolf, a plain, ordinary wolf.
By studying these and other species, we add to our knowledge of how life evolved, how it adapted itself to this world.
He went for a little walk. He did his face.
Welcome to the Return of the Monsters That Made Us, the podcast where we celebrate the spooktacular characters and films in the Universal Studios classic monster series. Today we'll be discussing the first straight-to-DVD installment, The Scorpion King 2, Rise of a Warrior. I'm the Invisible Dan Colon, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Monster Mike Manzi. How are you, Mike?
Dan, I just found out that inside every hero lies the potential for a monster.
Yes, how great is that line? I wrote that down as soon as I heard it. I think that's going to be our little caption for the episode. As I mentioned, this is the first film we're covering that did not have a theatrical release. Instead, it went straight to DVD, which is curious because the first Scorpion King movie did pretty well at the box office. But maybe it's because Dwayne Johnson decided he didn't want to return for another Scorpion King, and so maybe the studio lost a little bit of confidence in the IP. I don't really know. To be honest, I couldn't find a ton of information on this movie, so it's going to be a pretty bare-bones episode in that regard. But that's my guess, is they lost the rock and thought, okay, well, there's still some money to be had with The Scorpion King, so let's just do it on the cheap. We'll release it on DVD, and we'll put a new leading man in there. They made it a prequel. Also, I discovered that they released it on August 19th, which was just over 2 weeks after the release of The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. So it was kind of a 1-2 punch from Universal with their Mummy, Scorpion King properties.
Briefly on the direct-to-DVD stuff, I never wondered why we didn't get Mummy direct-to-DVD movies, you know? So it kind of makes sense that they wanted to continue that IP somehow, and this was a good way. It would have been cool, now that I'm thinking about it, if we got Van Helsing spin-off DVD movies. Like, that would be just as fun. So I'm just in the camp of I'll take whatever I can get at this point.
Yeah, I feel like a Van Helsing straight-to-DVD franchise could have been fun too, because obviously they're probably not going to get Hugh Jackman back, but they could have done that sort of secret society that tracks down these monsters, you know? Like, it could have been like that.
Van Helsing could have been a code name, how James Bond was once fabled to be sort of a code name passed on from one agent to another. Do that with Van Helsing. But here we are. I get it too. We don't need as big a budget. We can do this in the desert.
Yep.
And kind of get away with it. So.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. So now that we're officially on the Scorpion King road together, Mike, tell me your history with Scorpion King. I can't remember specifically if we've really gotten into the franchise. If my memory is correct, you have not seen anything past the first one until now.
That is correct. It's not sort of for like lack of trying or anything. Like, I just wasn't aware that there were this many. I would have watched this one if I came across it on TV or anything, but around the time it was released, 2008, you know, we were getting ready to graduate. It was not on my radar. I was just into other stuff around this time, maybe.
Sure.
It's kind of fun to come back to it now to see what was going on then. look, we're here. We're going to talk about what we like and try and be positive. But like, I think it's kind of obvious that this isn't necessarily the best. It just doesn't have the money. It doesn't have that. But I kind of feel like it's got some good stuff going on as well. Like, there's some reason to watch this.
Yeah, I was going to ask, my follow-up question was going to be, what are some of your hopes and expectations for the rest of these movies? And did this one kind of live up to those?
I was kind of expecting, like, from the last time we brought up Conan a lot, right? Conan the Barbarian. Mm-hmm. We both love Conan. That seemed to be like a fun Conan with like a bright disposition, like a friendly Conan. The vibe I got from this, I was kind of starting to dig, which felt like a young Conan TV show. You know, okay. It almost feels like they started there, or they had like an idea of that. And then maybe they wanted to make this into a show at some point. It has sort of those Xena vibes to it at times. Moving forward, I don't know really what to expect. You know, I'm going to focus on the storytelling and not try and focus so much on the production value and things like that. I'm just hopeful. Again, I don't want to be rude or anything, but like we can only kind of go up from here in many ways. I'm committed to this. You know, I said I'd do it. And I'm sure it's going to be fun. Okay. I've got lots of fun stuff to talk about. Well, maybe not lots of, but I've got some fun stuff to talk about in this episode. And like, it wasn't a complete waste of my time. I wasn't sitting there with my arms crossed or anything. I feel like it could have been a lot worse. It actually gets to a point at the end, I can't wait to get to, where it might eclipse just being bad and being sort of like so bad that like it's good. You know, It gets to a point of like, wow, is that a stroke of genius? Or was that just like they were going for something that completely missed the mark? But you know, sure. That's the very end, so we'll get there when we get there.
Just so our listeners know, I did ask you more than once if you wanted to include the Scorpion King movies this season. But as always, we will try to find the good in everything that we watch and try to focus on that. But yeah, I mean, there's no beating around it. It's a low budget production. There's, you know, low quality production value at times. I don't think that the acting like across the board is really anything to write home about, which is unfortunate. I think the loss of The Rock really makes this one suffer a bit. Some of the dialogue, man, I was rolling my eyes quite a bit. Some of that dialogue, I don't know that some of the best actors could deliver it without it sounding really kind of stilted. No, I think on a broad level, there's some really fun stuff in here. You saw this as sort of a young Conan. I kind of thought it felt like a D&D adventure.
Oh, yeah.
We got our main character, our hero. We've got his group of comrades, and they're on an adventure seeking a magic item, right? The fabled Sword of Damocles.
Oh, man. I can't wait to talk about how this messes with, you know, the lore and legend of our universe.
Yes. Yeah, in that way, I kind of found a way to enjoy it. Just like the Scorpion King before it, like the Mummy movies, this one does try to do as much practically as they can, which I thought was really cool. Like, they shot it in a desert, so kind of naturally they get this production value, so they can sort of shoot this ancient Middle Eastern story, and you just get all that natural production value.
Well, maybe a mistake I made was, at the time of this recording, watching Dune Part 2 last night before watching this, because that also takes place in a desert, okay? And you're like, oh yeah, great, like minimum production value. But no, like, he makes it epic and grand and the scope, right? So I feel like that's basically what's missing from here, is like the scope.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
Sort of like squeezed back down into a 4x3 box here.
Even when they go to the underworld, when it's like this supernatural realm.
Best part of the movie.
It should be limitless, right? It should be enormous in size because it doesn't have to adhere to the laws of physics.
It can be anything, yeah.
The fact that that whole section of the movie takes place in what feels like a very confined area sort of speaks to that idea that this should have been a huge feeling movie and it feels very, very small. And that's probably a lot to do with the fact that they didn't have a whole lot of money. You know, they only had so many locations they could use in South Africa, which is where they shot it.
And I'll tell you what, I could have seen this script, okay, as like the next adventure for The Rock. You know, mm-hmm, this could have easily been done as, you know, not a prequel. Like, I feel like all of this stuff of The Rock has to go to the underworld to grab a magical item to kill the new guy trying to be the Scorpion King, that could have worked. Okay, so maybe some of this is like remnants of that as well, that they're trying to rewrite to make it different enough so that they could like repackage it as like, oh, well, like, we don't have The Rock. So like, this is the young Rock. We're doing young Rock this time.
I would say it technically exceeded my expectations because, like with any straight-to-video sequel, or in this case, a prequel, my expectations are always very low. I was expecting to really not like this very much, and I'm not going to say that it is a masterpiece by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm not going to say that's a waste of time either. I do think that there's some really fun stuff in here if you can get past the acting and the terrible dialogue.
Yeah.
There's a lot more bad than there is good, but there is enough good that I think it's worthwhile.
Yeah, and I also sometimes wonder if I'm at an advantage because, like, I do another show which watches a lot of terrible movies just because it's about watching the third film in a franchise. Mm-hmm. And 9 times out of 10, that's just a very bad movie. Right now, I don't know how else to cut to the chase about it, okay? But, like, I'm kind of programmed watching stuff to think that, well, like, I gotta put aside production value at some point if I'm gonna get through these, and like focus as much as possible on, does it at least make sense? Are they at least pulling off what they're trying to do enough for this to be a competent film?
Sure.
So I like bad movies. I like movies that don't work. And I don't just like them because they're bad. Like, I actually like trying to find fun things about those movies to enjoy. So it's like almost a challenge sometimes. We're sort of at least ankle deep in that territory tonight.
100%. And I can tell you right now, if I had seen this in 2008 when it was released, I probably would have unabashedly hated it. Back when I was a pretentious film student and I was watching only Criterion movies, this would have been trashed. But I've matured and softened, and I've seen so many bad movies up to this point that I kind of started to like them. So, you know, let's get right into it here.
Yep.
Like I said, kind of a bare bones episode in this regard. I don't have a ton of information. I did find out that the original title was The Scorpion King: Rise of the Akkadian, which I like better than The Scorpion King 2: Rise of a Warrior.
Yeah, yeah.
Scorpion King 2 sounds like a sequel. Rise of a Warrior sounds generic.
I agree with that because it's like, which warrior are they referring to? By the end of the movie, we know, but there's more than one. Like, this could also be about Sargon.
Sure.
You know, because he rose through the ranks in this movie as well. And Akkadians, you know, I'm familiar with that phrase from the first movie, okay? Which we're going to have to talk about some possible retconning going on here.
My guess is that they balked on Rise of the Akkadian because if you've never seen a Scorpion King movie, you might not have any idea what an Akkadian is, right?
What about Scorpion King, the Sword of Damocles?
Right.
Like, that is so, but that is so confusing. We'll get there because I'm confused too. Like, what does one thing have to do with the other? It's like, that's part of the reason I'm a little impressed about this movie is because it found ways to like work in the Minotaur. It's going to get a little nutty here.
It combines Greek, Egyptian, and like Mesopotamian mythology. Filming began in October 2007 in Cape Town, South Africa, which is where they shot the entire film. It wasn't a big globe-trotting production like the previous Mummy films. It was once again produced by Sean Daniel and James Jax. They are, of course, the executive producers of the Mummy trilogy, and they've produced all of the Mummy-related films up to this point.
All right.
Fun fact, when we get into the movie, I mean, I'll mention it now. So I watched the opening credits, which, by the way, in papyrus font, already not a great sign.
Although the opening sort of like shadow box kind of thing, like the silhouettes across the fire.
Yeah.
It gave me Bram Stoker, Dracula Coppola vibes.
Yeah.
I mean, not nearly as proficient, but I was getting vibes.
Sure. Also, I noticed that Sean Daniel's name was misspelled in the credits.
No.
Yeah, his name is Sean Daniel, but in the credits, it says Sean Daniels.
Well, as long as we're getting into gaffes, I got one we can get out of the way early.
Sure.
In the movie, the Black Scorpions, they get scorpion tattoos.
Yeah.
The actor also has a Celtic cross tattoo because that snuck through in a scene. And there's like clearly 4 scenes in the movie where he's just got a cloak draped across one shoulder so they don't have to use makeup on it. But I kept looking for that Celtic cross. I was like, is he part of another society? Did he get over to like Ireland at some point?
I mean, I'm sure it was a mistake, but I do know that the Roman Empire stretched as far as Ireland. So it's possible.
Oh, they should have worked it in. They should have sent him there as part of his training.
But also, where is it on the rock?
Side note, because we're a podcast, this also had me thinking because we're in prequel mode. And I was like, prequel TV show or something? I want a show about Braveheart between the time like his uncle came and took him and the time he comes back to marry that lady from his original village. Like all of those adventures, like the young Indiana Jones, but like little Bobby Braveheart and his uncle on the wagon crossing the country.
In the director's chair, we've got Russell Mulcahy. So a little bit about Russell Mulcahy. Most recently, he directed a lot of the Teen Wolf TV series.
Oh, okay.
He did 40 episodes of that. Plus, he directed the Teen Wolf the movie, which was released last year. But prior to getting The Scorpion King 2, he was most well known, at least to my eye, for directing two things. Well, three things. So first, 1986's Highlander.
Yeah, there may only be one.
And its 1991 sequel, Highlander 2, The Quickening, and music videos. He directed like a ton of music videos for artists, including but not limited to Elton John, Duran Duran, Kim Carnes, Rod Stewart, Fleetwood Mac, Def Leppard, The Rolling Stones, Queen, and Billy Joel. Wow. Shout out to the Glass Houses podcast who had us on last year. Check out that episode.
Fantastic. He's got some other pretty big films in here too, like The Shadow.
Yep.
With Baldwin. That's a fun one. Ricochet with Denzel. Like he did a Resident Evil in there somewhere. Did he do the one I covered? Part 3? Extinction? I think so. Wild.
Yeah. Cool.
From Australia as well. So those guys make some cool movies.
So we got the screenplay by Randall McCormick. I couldn't find a whole lot of information on him because he's only written 6 screenplays, and all of them between 1997 and 2012. His first being Speed 2 Cruise Control.
Nice.
His last being The Scorpion King 3, The Battle for Redemption. So we'll be talking about him again in our next Scorpion King episode. Let's get into the cast here. Michael Copan plays Matthias. Copan's career began on television where he starred as the Blue Power Ranger on Power Rangers Time Force in 2011.
Oh.
He had a recurring role on One Tree Hill for about 11 episodes in the second season, and he also landed a role in the direct-to-video movie Bring It On, In It to Win It.
I could see some of those Power Ranger moves in this movie probably, like coming out with the stunting and flipping and the swordplay.
I would say that the stunts and the swordplay are not great, but I don't think it's his fault. I think it's more editing. It's probably more how they assembled it in post-production.
There's one great stunt. I don't quite remember when it was. Matthias and his brother are fleeing and they like jump out of a window, but his brother tumbles out of the window, and it is one of the coolest, most awkward falls out of a window I'd ever seen in a movie. It was really good. Matthias's stunt double like jumps like a superhero.
Sure.
And the other guy looks like maybe he intentionally misjudged the jump and he like tumbles out of the window. I was like, wow, that's like a real fall. That was pretty impressive.
Since The Scorpion King 2, he has kept busy with mostly single episodes of television and low budget films, including a 2010 remake of 1988's Night of the Demons. In 2012, he began co-hosting a Christian radio show in his home state of Virginia. Saturday Night with Trina and Mike aired every Saturday night from 5 to 10 p.m. on 88.5 FM, The Current. I found no trace of it on the station's website, so I'm not sure it's still on the air. If you're from Virginia and you listen to 88.5 FM, The Current, let us know. Karen David plays Layla. Karen is a Canadian actor, singer-songwriter, originally born in India. She studied at the Guildford School of Acting in London, joined the original cast of the West End production of Mamma Mia before appearing in some Bollywood musicals in the early 2000s. Following The Scorpion King 2, she began appearing on American television, doing episodes of the short-lived Fox series Touch and Castle, but she's probably best known for her role in the short-lived ABC series Gallivant and The CW's Legacies, as well as Fear the Walking Dead.
Oh, okay. There's so much Walking Dead. I watched the one with Rick, the first episode of that one. That was pretty good.
The new spinoff?
Yeah, yeah. I haven't seen any of the other spinoffs yet, but I was like, let me check one of these out. So I rolled the dice, and I saw that Joe Bob hosted an episode where they did it on Last Drive-In, so I was like, oh, I'll check it out. I thought that was a good one.
So we've got Simon Quarterman as Ari, Aristophanes. He's probably the most recognizable member of this cast, at least to me.
Please tell me, where the hell do I freaking... Oh, Westworld!
Yes!
It just came to me. It was killing me, dude, because I really love this guy in Westworld. He was such an arrogant fucking asshole who, like, ran part of Westworld, and he was so good in that. I was like, this guy is, like, the standout performance.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, his character is probably the most fun. It's clear, at least next to the rest of this cast, that he's the one who is probably the best actor of the group. His resume is relatively short, though.
Yeah.
There's only about 7 feature-length films, including The Scorpion being King 2 and The Devil Inside. But like a lot of English actors, he's worked a lot on British television, including roles on Midsummer Murders and EastEnders. But yeah, I definitely remembered him from Westworld, and I thought, okay, cool, this guy's in here.
Dan, I know we say this often on the show because there's sort of a connection to Doctor Who with us and stuff. Like, we like that a lot. And like, if they ever get back around to just like a generic white dude playing Doctor Who, like, they should mine the Mummy franchise, because this is like the second guy I feel like could rock Doctor Who as a role someday.
Yeah, he's got the charisma for it. I think had he better dialogue in this, he could have really shown, you know.
I didn't realize it was him doing the voiceover until like he literally starts doing voiceover in the movie.
Yeah,
to like the action going. I was at first I was like, well, this is kind of just unnecessary. Voiceover in films always really tricky. But then we meet him and I realize, oh, he's the one telling it because he's the scribe and everything. I was like, you know, again, movie, like, that is kind of, I don't know if that was like a genius move or not, but I appreciated that.
He is the one character in this movie who is based on a real person. It's
really,
in a manner of speaking. So it's sort of like in A Knight's Tale when Paul Bettany playing Chaucer, you know, it's kind of like that. Aristophanes was a real person. He is commonly known as the father of comedy or the prince of ancient comedy. He was an author, a poet, all kinds of stuff.
He's a triple threat. He could sing, he could dance, he could act. See the name of some of these plays: the frogs, the birds, the clouds, the wasps, the knights. All right.
It was a simpler time.
Yes, yes.
422 BC. Yeah, I thought it was kind of neat to have like a real historical figure represented here, even though I'm sure he is not at all historically accurate.
That's cool. Again, that's a thing the movie kind of gets a point for with me, being like, hey, this guy was real, like, go check him out and maybe you'll learn something more not watching the movie, you know, like, that's kind of cool. Like, I wasn't aware that this dude really existed, and now to find that he might have been the king of comedy,
the original king of comedy. Yeah,
yeah, even more so. Like, I might have to go back and like do a little research. But Dan, you know, you opened the box, so I have to just keep going with real life kind of quote-unquote references. You know, at one point our brave heroes get trapped in a labyrinth and they have to fight a minotaur.
Yep.
But it is not Theseus that slays him, it is Matthias that slays the beast. We have like an alternate telling of a fake history of some kind, like from our world. And then also this whole business with Damocles, like, I had to Google it. It's come up a lot. This name is so cool, and Damocles' sword and all this, but like, it was just a normal sword.
Yep.
And like, the idea was, you know, it was sort of more of like a metaphor or something as to like how when you ruled, you always had like a sword dangling over your head at any minute, like, you know, it could always come swinging down on you, you know, and that was like anxieties of being in charge and everything. It was not like some kind of all-powerful relic from a role-playing game or anything,
right.
But I gotta say, I think it's kind of brave to just be like, that sounds cool, like, let's completely make it our own and do whatever the hell we want with it. So gotta give the movie some points for these little things.
The only thing that I wish they had done, considering that there was a real historical character in this story, is find some kind of clever way to explain why we know the Minotaur story as the Minotaur having been slain by Theseus.
Oh, yeah.
Or why we have never heard of the Sword of Damocles having magical abilities, right? Like, we have a writer in this cast of characters. Like, it would have been neat if they had found some way for the story to get misunderstood somehow. And like, so like, this is the real way it happened, but because of this, whatever happens, now we understand it as Theseus killing the Minotaur. You know what I mean? There was no sort of clever button on the end to sort of explain how those two things can exist at the same time.
You're thinking on a feature film, like, theatrical level.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, like, we don't have the time or money to get that cool and intricate at this point yet, you know, but that would have been awesome. Yeah, like, it's like we have to steal the sword from Damocles.
Okay, Randy Couture plays Sargon. Now, we didn't get The Rock, so we got Randy Couture.
All I have to say about that is then have him play Matthias. Just have him pick up the role. Have him be adult version of himself. Going into this, I thought he was going to be Scorpion. I thought he was going to be The Rock's character.
I mean, he does kind of become the Scorpion King, so there is that.
He becomes a Scorpion
King.
Yes, but not the one we're talking about.
Sure.
You know, it does go to expand upon the idea that there are lots of Scorpion Kings. So it's going to take time for Matthias to become his Scorpion King.
Right. So for our listeners who are not aware of MMA fighting or just sports in general, Randy Couture is a six-time UFC champion, now retired, and mostly working as a commentator in mixed martial arts.
And an expendable.
Yep. Prior to that, he spent time in the United States Army, where he learned wrestling and boxing. He had applied for the Army's freestyle wrestling team, but due to a clerical error, it resulted in him being sent to the Greco-Roman wrestling tryouts. And rather than wait a year to try out for the wrestling team he really wanted to be on, he tried out anyway. And he ended up making the Greco-Roman wrestling team despite his lack of experience. In the late 80s and early 90s, he was a U.S. Olympic team alternate, racked up a bunch of accolades from the NCAA. His UFC career lasted from 97 to 2011, but his acting career began in 2005 when he appeared in the direct-to-video Steven Seagal movie Today You Die.
Okay.
As you mentioned, he's also appeared in The Expendables. He's also appeared in The Hard Way with Luke Goss and Michael Jai White, a famous martial artist, movie martial artist, plus some TV, including The Unit and Hawaii Five-0. So not an extensive acting career, and there's probably a good reason for that, as evidenced by this movie.
Yeah, more of a presence.
Yes.
Right? More just there because he looks big and badass. He actually kind of reminded me of an engineer from Prometheus in this movie.
Yeah.
I was like, did a colony of engineers just like settle in ancient Mesopotamia or something and like, you know, set up shop the way some people think aliens, you know, came down and built the pyramids? Were they the engineers? Because right. Again, Dan, we just got like a whole crew of big, bald, burly white dudes running shit for some reason in the middle of the desert again.
That's right. Speaking of martial artists, Tom Wu plays Fong, underutilized in this movie, in my opinion. Wu is a Hong Kong-born British actor and martial artist. As a kid, he trained in Hung Kar, karate, and Wing Chun, and earned two bronze medals in China's International Wushu Tournament. In 1995, he helped found Yellow Earth Theater to help develop British East Asian talent, which is pretty cool. His film career began in 1988 and has continued to the present day, including roles in a number of high-profile films, including Shanghai Knights, Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life, Batman Begins, Revolver, Skyfall, Red 2, Kick-Ass 2, Hobbs and Shaw, among others.
Nice, yeah.
So he's like a go-to kind of stunt guy. When you want like some martial arts and a henchman or something, he's kind of one of those go-to guys.
I thought it was interesting that he only speaks Cantonese in the entire movie.
Yeah.
To a degree, it's used as like comic effect, is that it's almost treated like a droid or Chewbacca, where like everyone kind of understands exactly what he says, even though like there's no subtitles or anything, but everyone's like, yeah, that's right. And he really gets to show off, I believe, at the very end.
Yeah,
when they're putting out the fire.
For the most part, he's used as a punchline because he just wants to get back to China, and they keep telling him, well, the underworld is a shortcut to China. We've got Andreas Wisniewski, I think I say that right, as Pollux. He's sort of the leader of the prisoners that they encounter down in the labyrinth. He is he is 6'4" and a half inches tall.
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah. And he has pretty much made a career out of playing henchmen. He was Necros in The Living Daylights, Tony in Die Hard, and quote, Max's companion in Mission Impossible.
That is crazy that he was in one of my favorite Bond films, Living Daylights.
I love Living Daylights.
I didn't put any of that together. Cool.
Yep.
He's pretty good in this as like a guy who I would take doesn't normally get to say this many lines in a movie.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he just seems like a character actor to me.
He definitely seemed more comfortable in front of a camera than some of the other people that he was sharing scenes with.
Yeah.
But he began his career as a dancer before making his film debut in 1986's Gothic, which is a film about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Check Ooh. That out. He never really broke out as a star, but over the years, he has managed to stay active in films and on television. So he's still active. Yeah, he's still just kind of getting these little henchman roles or supporting roles. Natalie Becker plays Astarte. She is a native of Cape Town and is of Cape colored descent, which was brand new to me. That is basically a South African ethnic classification consisting of a mix of African, Asian, and European descent.
Okay.
She began in radio as an announcer for Good Hope FM before becoming a television presenter, and she made her film debut in 2007, just before The Scorpion King 2. And in 2008, she appeared with Meg Ryan and William H. Macy in The Deal, as well as with John Malkovich in Disgrace.
I wonder if she got that radio voice as the voice in this movie, where she starts like growling and sounding like a demon. She's also like in a couple Tremors sequels and a Death Race.
Yes. I was going to say, for those of us who are genre fans, she did Death Race 3, Inferno, and Tremors 5, Bloodlines.
I haven't seen a Tremors past part two. I wasn't aware that there were like six at least.
Yeah, there's something like that. I know I've seen some on Pluto TV on the Universal Monsters channel.
Not to go off track again, but there's Tremors in the Snow. Is that right? Tremors, A Cold Day in Hell, 2018. Okay, we'll get to that some other time, folks.
But yeah, we'll talk about that on our Tremors podcast.
Love those graboids.
Finally, he's not anybody super noteworthy. He wasn't even included on the Wikipedia cast list, but for the purposes of the story, I thought it only fair to mention Peter Butler as Asher, Matthias's father.
Oh, really? He's not mentioned, huh?
Yeah, he wasn't even mentioned in the wiki, and I couldn't find a lot of information on him. Nothing more than just his list of credits, which is kind of unfortunate.
Also in Death Race 3? Wow, that's weird.
He's also in Death Race 3. He's also in From Dusk Till Dawn 3.
He's also in Honey 3. Wow, he's a three-timer. And Kissing Booth 3. This guy only does part 3s after Scorpion King 2. Found my guy here for third time's a charm.
Yeah.
Got to get an interview with him. Is Maze Runner the Death Cure, the third Maze Runner? People, let us know.
That's it for our cast.
One other thing I just wanted to note about the cast. So there's actually been three actors to play Matthias. Because we get like a younger version of him. We don't really necessarily have to mention. I think he's this guy, Pierre Marais, possibly.
That's young yeah. Matthias.
Yep. Yeah. I just wanted to give him a shout out because I think it's cool that there's already been only two movies, but three actors playing the same character.
Yes. And then in the next Scorpion King movie, The Rock is officially replaced with Victor Webster. Ooh. As that is a sequel to the original Scorpion King. I think starting with three, they all kind of go forward in time. Yeah, so we'll have what, four actors playing Matthias over the course of these movies?
As we know, maybe even more. We'll see what happens.
Okay, so yeah, that's it for the cast. We can get right into the movie. So as I already mentioned, papyrus font for the credits, classic.
Post-Avatar, so taking notes from James Cameron, never go wrong.
That's a good point. The intro, it's pretty lengthy. I'm going to try and sum it up as succinctly as I can here. We establish Akkad, the Empire of Akkad, or the Kingdom of Akkad, is situated between the Tigris and Euphrates River. That is, as I was growing up as a kid, I learned that's called the Fertile Crescent, kind of where people believe like the beginning of civilization was.
The cradle, if you will.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, I grew up going to like private school, and oftentimes I would hear that historians believe the Garden of Eden was located someplace in the Fertile Crescent. This is like the beginning of time. The kingdom has this squad of black scorpions. They're not just the army, right? Because they have their army, but the black scorpions are like a special forces team within their army.
Yeah, what I kind of would equate them to for me mentally, just to get myself there immediately, I was like, okay, these are the Mandalorians, because they're not only like royal guards and shit, but they're also bodyguards. Yep. They're also bounty hunters. Like they're mercenaries. Like they go off and do like all kinds of other stuff once they're kind of anointed or whatever.
Yeah, they get special training that make them some of the deadliest warriors in the region.
Like on Earth.
Yeah.
I don't know. They call it Earth yet?
No, not yet.
Okay.
I don't think so.
What do you think they probably just like called it the world, right?
Sure. They've basically taken over, like they've conquered all of the local tribes, all the neighboring tribes in the area, expanding this kingdom of Akkad. Like you mentioned, they have become the personal bodyguards for the king. And the greatest of these black scorpions was a guy named Asher, who we will find out is Matthias's father. The greatest warrior they ever had. And he strictly forbade his son from following in his footsteps and becoming a black scorpion also. Yep. But like any headstrong child, he did not listen. When Matthias was a child, he wanted to try out for these gladiatorial games. And he and his friend Layla were introduced to young Layla in that scene as well. They sort of disguise themselves and join this like group of dudes, these group of warriors to try out for these games. And of course, Sargon recognizes something is off. He reveals Layla as being a girl, which that's forbidden. You know, like this is a society where if you're a girl or woman, you don't really get to do anything cool.
Yeah, you get to breed, basically.
That's pretty much it. Yeah.
That's the coolest thing you get to do.
Matthias defends her honor, attacks Sargon, and is about to lose a hand for that when Asher steps in. It's really just because of Asher's service to the king that Matthias is spared. But in exchange for that act, Matthias is then sort of guaranteed a spot with the Black Scorpions. Like he will now have to serve.
Yeah, there's a few things I'd like to touch on.
Yeah.
I thought these were the tryouts for the Black Scorpion, and that it's like they take 8 to 12 year olds, like the Jedi, they take them really young and then they craft them and mold them over like maybe a decade.
Yeah, that was kind of my understanding too.
Okay.
Because they call them the games, right? I feel like that's sort of a recruitment tool for the Black Scorpions. All right. Find out who has what it takes. I mean, I watched this once. My memories might be a little fuzzy.
The other thing I thought was cool here is that, like, we're getting, like, actual kids fighting, doing stunts. So, like, I just thought, like, this must be, like, local martial arts students and things. And, like, that was so cool. And, like, they don't pull any punches. Like, you see kids, like, beat the shit out of each other in this sequence, which I was like, well, that's pretty shocking. That makes up for some of the bad production. I'm just saying, like, that's kind of risky to start a movie like that. And then it's also, though, tempered with a very sitcom-ish vibe where it's like, Matthias, you're not supposed to be here. If your dad ever finds out, and it's like, well, don't tell my dad and I won't tell anyone you're a girl, you know? And they, so, like, that's kind of off balance.
Yes.
Still, it's like economic storytelling. Like, you know, we've introduced dad, future girlfriend, future bad guy, you know, this bad guy, Sargon, which is a cool name. I think Sargon's a cool name. He's going to be the guy in charge of choosing the Black Scorpions, but then later he's actually going to be like running the whole show. He usurps the king. But so far, like, this training stuff wasn't the worst. I thought, like, what happens next was a little confusing. We get a guest appearance by the smoke monster from Lost.
So Sargon is, I would characterize him as being kind of jealous of Asher for finding favor with the king. Sargon, we find out, has these, like, black magic abilities.
Right.
And, like you said, sends the smoke monster from Lost to go kill Asher. And I think that scene is pretty gnarly because Matthias runs in and he's, like, covered in these scorpions. His body is decaying. He kind of looks like... Do you remember that scene in Halloween 3?
Oh, yeah.
When the woman gets killed in her motel room? He kind of looks like that by the end of the sequence.
Yeah, it's gruesome. They're able to sneak some stuff in, you know, and there's going to be some pretty sick stuff at one point later in the underworld.
Yep.
It's here and there for me. This is what I mean by throughout. There's just like, oh, that was a cool idea. I wish they were able to sort of execute that in a better way.
So now Asher is dead and Matthias has to spend 6 years training with the Black Scorpions. They all go out to some other location for training, right? He is away from his whole family, everyone he knows and loves for that entire 6 years. He comes back to Akkad and he's, of course, the best in his class, pretty much.
Yeah, he's the best son. Like, his dad was the best.
Yes.
So he had to be the best. We didn't get to see them get their scorpion tattoos.
So, nope.
You know, they already have them and they're going to get infected.
Yes.
Like, my pet peeve in film is tattoos. Like, and before I started working at a shop, and it's just like, you know, it's just not portrayed right. Like, that is just not sanitary. And I was dying to see how they were going to give each other tattoos in this movie. I was kind of bummed we didn't see like some ancient technique of like, you know, sticking and poking it.
Yeah, we don't get to see it, although we do get to see what does not appear to be an accurate method of tattoo removal later on. I'm very excited to talk about that with you.
It's better than some other methods I've seen documented.
Matthias returns. He's top of his class. The king is no longer the king. Sargon has usurped the previous king and taken the crown for himself. He doesn't immediately recognize Matthias until he reveals himself.
Yeah, we meet Matthias's mom.
Yep, his brother.
His brother. And spoiler, his brother's gonna die in this movie, but I thought he rescued his brother at the beginning of the one with the rock. Isn't that what that was all about? Like, he breaks into like the cabin in the Arctic and he's like rescuing his brother and his two friends, and it's like, oh, we're the last of the like Akkadians and everything. That he comes from this city, he's like Aladdin or something, you know. It's just like any other, you know, any other kid. But then he catches this break where, you know, now he's an awesome warrior and everything. But I was just a little confused at some of the retconning going on here. I know he's coming from the Black Scorpions, but I thought he came from like a badass tribe of like crazy wild people.
I'm going to just guess that he has more than one brother. I hope that they find a way to explain that in the 3 sequels we have ahead of us.
Was there possibly a line about how he did it and the other brother was like away maybe? Or was I watching something else in between?
Nothing immediately comes to mind.
Possible that I turned this off, watched something else, and then came back to it.
Right. So, yeah, no, you're right, though, that he has a brother here who dies pretty early on. And then the Scorpion King King, the first one, starts with him rescuing a brother. So clearly a lot of years pass between this movie and that one. I'm hoping that he ends up with another brother, but age-wise, it doesn't really make sense. Even to have a new child with Matthias being, let's say, 18 years old, that's still quite an age gap. I don't think a lot of things are going to make sense.
I know, and that's why I just wanted to do one up top and get it out of the way, because I'm not going to sit here and nitpick the entire movie. I just wanted to express that it's that kind of thing where it's like they're kind of just do their own thing, and maybe this exists in like an alternate dimension.
Sure.
You know, it's not going to line up. So at this point on, I'm not going to make a thing of it.
You know, I also keep it in the back of my mind, that theory that we received from one of our listeners, that there are multiple descendants of Matthias and the Scorpion King. So
even Ari was like, we don't know. What happened to this one? Like, this guy, he went on and did other stuff. It's not like he says, and then he went on to become like a scorpion monster and get stabbed by Rick.
Definitely not the only retcon. And there's a lot of stuff here that doesn't really line up with the first Scorpion King. But that's, like you said, that's just the kind of movie it is. Okay, so he's reunited with his family, with Layla. That night, Sargon sends for him and knows that he is the son of Asher and decides to make Matthias one of his personal bodyguards, or maybe his singular personal bodyguard.
Yeah. And this is like the thing where it's like, oh, it's the son of the guy who is better than me. So like, now I'm going to try and be like, forcefully be like a father figure to him.
Sure.
That's like the scene, you know. It doesn't go according to plan, but that's the scene. And then he drags out Matthias's brother and he's like, you gotta kill your brother, then you can become my son, essentially. You know, that's how it felt, like, ritualistically.
Yeah, he basically lays it out that being his bodyguard requires absolute loyalty and devotion. Like, he even has one of these other bodyguards prove his loyalty by, like, impaling his own hand with a dagger. Yeah. Absolutely insane. And then gives him access to all of these beautiful women. And then the following day immediately tests his loyalty by having him execute his brother for slander.
It's almost like Harkonnen. Now, like, not just because I just watched Dune 2, but, like, this is the savagery where it's like they'll just be talking and one of them will just like slit some dude's throat and they'll go on with the rest of their day, and it's just like, well, that's their nature, I guess. Like, okay, right. They're aliens, but they're getting the same sort of vibe here.
For sure. Of course, Matthias does not kill his own brother. He frees him, and together they fight off these guards. There's a really sick moment towards the end of the fight where Matthias launches this spear right at Sargon, and that's where Matthias learns that Sargon has some sort of magical abilities. He can stop that spear midair, spin it around, and launch it right back at Matthias.
Which I'm liking that this guy's a warlock or whatever. I'm not liking that we don't have the scene where he communes with his higher force, or where he gets his... We get that a little later. We find out who he's worshiping to get his powers, I guess. I do like, though, that we're keeping up with the magic and all that kind of the mysticism in this one, as well as from the first one,
too. Yeah, it depends on how you approach screenwriting. There are some different schools of thought in terms of magic, and like, you shouldn't mix and have like more than one kind of magic, right? This kind of draws from three different cultures. But I think it manages to do it in a way that I don't spend my time thinking, well, that doesn't make sense. He can't do that. Like, it all just sort of feels like it belongs together. So I think
what helps is we have a character, literally, like Ari at one point will be like, no, don't go to Egypt. Like, you're going to find like crazy mummies and you don't want that spear. That has to do with other, like, let's go over this way and go to Greece and like adventure on that side and find all the weird stuff in our universe that occurred over there. Yeah. So like, kind of, again, that's sort of a clever bit that it can do. That is like, it's like world building, you know, and like, that's such simple world building, just to be like, don't go over there. We've been there before. Like, let's go over here. This is new.
In a weird way, it's kind of refreshing in 2024 to hear people so accepting of other cultures and religions, and like, oh yeah, like you said, in Egypt, they know that there's like these gods, and then in Greece, they have those, and they all exist. They all just accept that it's all real. Yeah. Oh, love it. So Matthias frees his brother, they escape, and then in a cool scene, like, I mean, this was like straight Guardians of the Galaxy here.
Oh yeah, totally, Yondu.
Yes, Sargon like launches this arrow through the city. It sort of winds its way through the city towards Matthias and his brother Noah as they ride off into the distance on horseback.
Yeah, it's like a chase scene.
It's a really cool scene. And then of course the arrow impales Noah and kills him.
Like, it kind of sounds goofy talking about it, like, I'll admit, but, and conceptually, you'd be like, really? They're getting chased by an arrow, but there's, like, a weird threat to, you know, it's like that thing, like, it's not going to stop. It's like the Hunter-Seeker. More Dune stuff going on here instead of everything. But again, like, it is just like that, you know? There's some kind of this, like, it's never going to stop until it hits one of us, heat-seeking kind of thing to it.
Yeah, I think it's a really cool scene. And then now, effectively, Matthias is a fugitive. Pretty much keeps a low profile in the streets of Akkad.
Gotta say, there's some pretty competent digital matte paintings throughout this entire film. We get a couple of them here. The one where they're running away from the arrow and you see it kind of glint. That was a nice touch. Like, it's just a tiny little effect. And it's like, oh, it's the sun hitting the arrow, chasing after him. And you see it gaining on him.
The effects here, some work really well, some don't. I think where it goes wrong is when they try to use a lot of digital effects in like the action set pieces. We're gonna get to it, and I actually really like the way they handled the Minotaur, the way that they kind of did more with less. You know, when you have your giant scorpion towards the end of the movie, it's actually like really dicey. With the matte paintings, I think that's definitely some strong use of digital effects. So now Matthias is reunited with Layla. She is insistent on coming with him as he is on his way to Egypt. We find out he's going to go to Egypt and find the Spear of Osiris. Where have we heard that before?
We get him buying tickets. You know, everyone's buying tickets to get on the boat to Egypt. That was kind of funny.
Especially when the dude tried to upsell him on the ticket insurance. I was like, this feels anachronistic to me, but sure. They also meet Aristophanes, who's going to be a major element in this story.
Yeah, on the boat.
Already sort of touched on it, but here's the backstory. We learn this on the boat to Egypt. Matthias's father, Asher, once helped the Pharaoh of Egypt, and so Matthias intends to go there as the son of Asher and cash in that favor, right, and use the Spear of Osiris to defeat Sargon. But as we learn from Ari, the Spear of Osiris is only effective against Egyptian monsters, which he calls out like cursed mummies and things.
Yeah, and like jackals and stuff, which I thought that's awesome. Like, certain relics only effective against certain things. And it's funny also how it sort of borders the worlds and the countries based on their beliefs, but everything's real. Like, it's all real. Like, what everything they believe that is like supernatural, like it all happened. I don't know. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, no, I really love that. It's Ari's idea. Instead, let's go get the Sword of Damocles. According to him, it was transformed by lightning from Zeus, and it can cut through anything, mortal or immortal.
It's so much kind of cooler to like turn it into an actual thing to use than to just be like a metaphor.
Yes.
And it sounds really cool. You know, it's funny. It struck me that like Matthias's dad, like we'll learn, he helped a lot of people out.
Right.
Not just the Pharaoh, but like basically everyone they run into is like, oh, who's your dad?
Right.
I owe him a life debt.
Yeah. Asher just went around doing favors for everybody.
Setting up his son's adventure, right?
That's right. So they get to Greece. They change courses. Instead of going to Egypt, they travel across the Mediterranean to Greece.
After being told they have to venture into the underworld.
Yes.
To get this sword, they're like, all right, why not?
Yeah.
All right, sure.
And so they end up sneaking into this. They don't really describe what it is. They're just like, we have to get there, is what we know, as they put to this thing up on top of the hill.
It looked like a temple or a palace or like where they used to worship. Getting Clash of the Titan vibes from this whole sequence.
I do love that they turn to Layla like, hey, use your feminine wiles to sneak past those guards. And she like walks up to them and just like beats the shit out of them with a bag full of rocks.
Dude, this is going to be a fun moment later where Layla and Astarte have like the world's longest sword fight off screen.
Yeah.
You know, you just hear him going like like clanging away, but it's like, yep, she's, you know, she's just here to kick ass.
A lot of ADR that day. They make their way into that building, essentially fall into what is the labyrinth, the fabled labyrinth of the Minotaur, but we don't know that that's where they are yet.
Not yet, but they drop it pretty quick. They drop the name King Midas as well, right? Which was kind of like, oh, okay, I guess like you could have made up anything, but you know, like we didn't need that Minotaur. There could have been multiple, like the way there's lots of mummies, there's lots of Minotaurs. It's like the Rancor, like it just guards your shit.
Sure.
If you're a powerful dude and you have to feed it minions every once in a while.
They do encounter these like prisoners who are essentially there to be fed to the Minotaur, because I think the Minotaur has to be fed once a day or bad things will happen. I don't remember the consequences.
I guess it'll get too ornery and like break out, probably just won't listen.
They sort of make friends with these prisoners in a weird way. Like you said, Matthias's father did somebody a favor and they are sort of duty bound to help Matthias.
But also like the idea that Matthias and Layla are just like, screw this.
Yeah.
Like, we're not staying here. And they literally just like open the cell. I was like, wait a second. Shouldn't that be kind of locked or anything? But no. And they're just, but I guess the whole thing's a prison. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, Ari locks himself in. He's like, I'm not going out there.
But I feel like partially their kind of bravado turns around the other dudes as well to kind of follow.
They don't immediately join him. I know for a little while, Matthias and Layla are kind of traveling through this labyrinth. And then they come across Fong, who, like you mentioned, does not speak any English. He only speaks Cantonese.
And this, I started thinking, like, this is kind of like horror movie type stuff.
Yeah.
Like, we're finally getting a little bit of that, like, sneaking around the dungeon.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of Alien, you know, where you only had flamethrower light to see, and you're in these dark hallways.
In a weird way, when they came across Fong, I was thinking, like, ancient Saw. They did a Saw film that took place in ancient Greece. Like, once they come across that Fong guy, like, the actor is, like, so good. Like, his energy is so up. He is scared out of his mind. Like, I believe the guy that something's coming after him.
Yeah. I actually really like Tom Wu's performance here. I just wish they had given him more to do. He seems mostly there for comic relief until the end when they need him as a martial artist.
He survives.
He does survive. Once Pollux and his men realize who Matthias is, they decide they're going to help. And then there's a fight scene with this Minotaur. And I really did like how they shot this scene with the Minotaur, because they clearly used a lot of practical effects. They used a Minotaur suit, but they only shot it in like brief pieces, like little glances of it. You never really get a good solid look at it. And so it really sells the idea that this thing actually exists in the room with them. So I think there's like one full quick body shot, and that's probably CG. But for the most part, I really enjoyed, they just kind of did everything they could to not really give you a good look at it.
I agree with you for the most part. Like, they have all the coverage of this thing and they got all the inserts in it. I kind of wish we did have one or two more hero shots of the costume, of the even if it was animatronic and composited onto the screen with real, like, even if it was janky, because even in like Clash of the Titans, my mind accepts these two things sharing a space together. If it's like claymation and a real dude or whatever, like, my mind can handle it. Everything was like cut really well, and the action is cool. It's like scraping its horns with the sparks. It was gourding people with its horns. I just wanted like one big shot of it giving the big scream. I'm glad we got what we got. You know, at least they fought a freaking Minotaur.
Yeah, no, it was a cool scene. So now with the Minotaur defeated, they wander into the center of the labyrinth. That's where they believe the portal to the underworld to be. Ari finds these markings on the floor and somehow opens up this portal to the underworld. And the way this is executed is pretty cool. It's a little bit Indiana Jones, I thought. It literally breaks open. The bricks from the room kind of like disappear, and they find themselves on this giant tower in the middle of a desert. And there's all this talk of following your faith,
taking that first leap of faith and trusting that step, like, take that first step off.
It's sort of like Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade moment, where he just has to step out over the edge, and he does, and this big step shoots out, and he goes to take the next step and he falls, but it's an optical illusion because he falls about, you know, like 4 feet.
Yeah, that's a good bit. This is my favorite chunk of the movie, is the underworld. Like, they do a lot of fun stuff here. They're going to be wandering through the desert, and then these giant thorns come out of the ground, and then they're in like a thorn forest. And the thorns look cool for what we got. I wasn't expecting that to happen. And then it's like, oh, we're not just sort of in the underworld. We're like, we're in hell. It's going to get visually very close to stuff like Dante's Inferno and shit. And like, they start wandering through like a dead forest. They're like half bodies growing into the trees with tentacles shooting out of their chests and mouths and shit. It's like really Giger messed up kind of aliens.
Yeah.
Kind of stuff at one point. I was like really impressed with creepy forest stuff.
It reminded me of a sort of natural approach to Hellraiser.
Yeah, an organic kind of version of that. in this movie, I was like, wow, there's a lot of practical makeup. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of digital stuff. It's all kind of working for me in this sequence here. There's like giant spiders.
There's big tentacles coming out of the mouths of these half corpses.
That was very Resident Evil. I think maybe he picked that up from one of the earlier Resident Evil movies. I dug it. Even when they get up to Astarte, is that
Astarte? Yeah.
Astarte? Sounds like a pop singer. Astarte, opening for Dazzler tonight at the X-Mansion. Like, even when they get to her, like, she's gorgeous. She has, like, this ribbon powers with her dress, right? Yep. That's really cool. She's got this crazy spine thing going on. Uh-huh. She's, like, the big bad of the movie. We find out all this crazy shit. We got the spinning sword. Everything that happens down here, for me, is the movie.
I didn't know anything about Astarte before this movie. This was my introduction to her. I apologize to the historians. She was worshipped from the Bronze Age through classical antiquity, and her name is particularly associated with her worship in the ancient Levant among the Canaanites and the Phoenicians. So she's like a Canaanite goddess. They went through the Greek underworld to find a Canaanite goddess, so that doesn't totally jive.
But it's still love and war, which is cool. You know, she's the goddess of love and war. See, I don't know. Again, I'm giving movie some points because of the way it retrofits all of this stuff. It's just a character in a story. It's a version you could borrow and take. It's almost like mixtape kind of filmmaking, right? He's like, I'm taking lore from everywhere and we're going to mash it up into a blender.
This scene essentially plays out where Layla fights Astarte. Astarte is also trying to bring Matthias into the underworld with her. She's got this seductive thing going on. And while that's all happening, Ari and Fung go find the Sword of Damocles. They do manage to get it through some like acrobatic work.
Yeah, because it's kind of hanging out by her throne room. Astarte, they find like her throne room and they're like, well, the sword's got to be here. I thought it was funny how it was like spinning. I thought for sure it was going to decapitate Fung. I was like, I would have bet in Vegas that it was going to decapitate him.
No, he's got to make it to the end. So they get the sword. Matthias essentially saves Layla and spurns Astarte, which will have its consequences later.
Well, she's got bigger plans, too. She's got machinations we can't see. She's not exactly happy with Randy Couture, exactly. I feel like she's setting up some stuff where it's like, all right, I'll let you take the sword, but, you know, eventually you'll come around. It's like a Sith kind of thing. You'll be my next one.
I missed this. It happens kind of in between, like when they're on their way from the desert into this nightmare forest. We learn that Sargon has this magic pool that he can view it. Sort of like in The Mummy, Artithe, he has this like pool where he can view what Matthias is up to.
Right. Yeah, they should have utilized that a little more. That would have been fun.
I kind of was like, oh, right. Randy Couture is in this movie.
He's about to get an upgrade, Sargon. He's going to level up in a minute or so.
Let me just say that since we just mentioned the Sword of Damocles, could no one design a cooler looking sword? I thought it was pretty generic. I was not impressed.
You're not wrong. I just felt like it was huge.
It was like, big, yeah.
It was enormo, right? Like it was like a giant's sword. And so in that sense, I was like, okay, it's impressive. I mean, it's very plain looking, but it is an impressive size for a sword. I didn't realize what you meant as far as like, no, it needed way more decoration.
Correct. Yeah.
You know, like a jewel or something or some fillery on the hilt.
For this mythic legendary sword, this magic item.
I also later expected it to be set on fire.
Sure. It doesn't do anything cool. It's just totally impervious to anything. I can cut through whatever.
At one point, one of the guards sees it cut through a sword, and the guard is like, what is this sorcery? It's like, your boss is like a crazy magic monster. What are you talking about? What is this sorcery? Like a sword cut through. I'm sure it's not the only sword that could cut through a sword. Like it should shoot like the master sword or something. That cracked me up so hard.
You're essentially laying out all the stuff I thought that sword should have been. I also forgot to mention that one of the rules with the underworld is that mortals can only exist in the underworld for an hour or they will turn to stone. That's basically what we saw in that forest. Other people who didn't make it back.
They have an hour. He has like a pocket watch that's like a sand dial thing or
it's
something.
It's a sand dial he wears around his neck.
Which, how does that work? But still fun. They did another thing that reminded me of when The Rock had that cool telescope. They did some kind of like science with rocks looking up at the sun at one point, I believe, when trying to find like their direction. And yeah, the dude turning into stone was pretty well done. And plus his entire crew gets wasted in the underworld. Like they all. Greed or whatever, like they're all taken out by creatures.
They were convinced to join them in the underworld by the promise of treasure and fortune and all that sort of shit. And of course, that's the sticking point at the end. On their way out, he's like, hey, where's all these riches that you told us would be here? And Ari finds like a ruby ring on a corpse.
And he literally like breaks it off the finger like Beetlejuice, right? Yeah. And has like the finger with the ring on it and like stuffs it in his pocket. And he's like, this is good. Oh, that's enough treasure for me.
But it's just enough time for him to not make it back in time. No. He turns to stone. Meanwhile, we cut back to Sargon. And this is where we learn of his arrangement with Astarte. She's been kind of behind the whole thing. Yeah. She's given Sargon the powers that he does have. He agrees to return the sword of Damocles in exchange for more power.
He needs that power up front. That, so she gives him a scorpion crown tattoo on his head.
Head tattoo.
Now we know how they used to do it back in the day.
Yes. They would just magic it onto you.
Dan, if I paid, would you get that? You have to actually wear it exposed for a year.
Yeah, okay, that's a fair condition. I don't know if I would agree to that.
I wouldn't. You did the right thing.
I passed the test.
I kind of like the idea of a tattooed crown on something, you know, like maybe in the wastelands of Mad Max, the Black Guzzly and all that kind of stuff. Like sure. The guy who runs one of the weirdo towns tattooed a crown on his actual head.
In concept, I really think it's a fun idea. The design, I think, could have been better. It's a bold choice and it's going to foreshadow things to come in our climax here. So now, like, we're kind of in the final third of this movie. Once they get out of the underworld with the sword, it's really no big task to get back to Akkad, and Matthias is going to show down with Sargon. But Sargon's not done. He's got some tricks up his sleeve. Suddenly Asher shows up, and that's a confusing moment for Matthias. And so I think while that's happening, Layla and Fong are realizing that the city guard are about to do something awful with these big pots of oil and the city's water supply.
Yeah, this was kind of weird. It was compelling because I was like, what the hell is going to happen? But the entire city is like lured into the Colosseum, and in the middle is like this weird machine, and a guy like starts the machine and it becomes like...
It's like a Rube Goldberg device, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And it's breaking all these things and it's doing all this stuff. And then all of this oil, which I just thought it was water, but like all this water starts to feel like a very intricate kind of carving in the ground, and it goes into the walls, and then just oil just starts like gushing from the walls everywhere. And so it's like covering everything with oil, and then you see like guards with flaming arrows about to just set everyone fire.
All of that pretty much happens during the Matthias and Sargon fight scene.
Now is that a mass sacrifice for Astarte?
I guess.
Wasn't quite sure what was happening
there. It's not super clear.
Why does he want to murder all of his people?
His subjects, yeah.
He wouldn't have a kingdom anymore.
Right. Yeah. It's not super clear, at least based on one viewing. Yeah.
Okay. Unclear. It's something to keep them busy while Matthias and Sargon throw down. Plus, Ari wasn't there, so we're not sure it's being told correctly.
That's true. We will learn that he is an unreliable narrator.
But he has been scribing the whole movie. He's just like whip out his little notepad and be like,
He's scribing during this fight scene.
More movie points for that. That is awesome. Like, you wouldn't get away with that if this was actually like, I feel maybe, actually, it's kind of got that Van Helsing vibe, as if like his little helper was like under a table writing everything that happened.
Right.
I really like that aspect of this, where even Sargon's like, you better get this straight. When I kill him, you tell him I, you know, get my name right, and he's gonna let him live. He lets him live, and he's like, I'm letting you live so you tell this right.
Over the course of this fight scene, Ari has kind of a heel turn. Matthias loses the sword. Ari tosses it back to Sargon, and then
and Sargon's like, ha ha ha, finally I could tell you that Ari was on my side the whole time. I sent you to hell. I wanted you to steal the sword from my girlfriend so that she would give me more power and I'd get the sword and the power.
Right. And he was basically bribing Ari with like all kinds of riches, which he gives him in exchange for the sword. Ari takes off. And as soon as they get back into fighting, that sword breaks immediately. Ari bursts back in with the real sword.
Yeah, that was a replica.
Yes.
Makes me wonder, in universe, if Sargon wanted that sword so bad, he went out and he bought a knockoff
so that he could have that until he had the real one.
Yeah, maybe.
And he couldn't tell by the weight. That's something in the movies all the time where like a gun has a clip in it or it's loaded as like the weight and everything. I thought that was fun.
Or like in Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, where he's being cursed, but all he can feel is that something magical is happening to him until he realizes, oh shit, it's a curse. It's not the thing that I needed.
I get the magic tingle, but it's not, I don't know if it's good or bad yet.
Sargon points out that Matthias is still a black scorpion and owes him his allegiance, at which point Matthias removes the tattoo by burning it off with the sword.
Yes.
Which I've never seen as an effective tattoo removal method.
Not recommended. However, I've seen worse than branding it off your body. You don't want to see those pictures. And people nowadays don't know what to do either. Folks, always call a shop first, but there are places where you could get your tattoo removed very efficiently and safely these days with the lasers and the cooling and all that.
Yeah.
I will say one more thing. Fucking badass, because this dude does not feel pain.
No.
You know, because he's had this tattoo fresh. I mean, you could dry heal, but not in the desert with all the sand and the underworld with like all of the death cooties and everything going on down there. His arm was going to fall off at some point. Crazy. It just blew my mind.
They didn't have Aquaphor.
No bag bomb. No A&D.
So with that, with Matthias no longer recognizing that he is a black scorpion, Sargon retreats into the shadows as he kind of transforms into his final form, which we discover is an invisible scorpion.
Brilliant. Like, he is a giant invisible scorpion. Like, there's a shot of the giant scorpion before, like there's just one quick shot of it, and I was like, oh sweet, just use that model. That CG model is not bad. Like, it's on par with the Minotaur. And then I'm like, why aren't we seeing appendages or like any props or like a tail or like a stinger? And then I'm like, is it invisible? And then it kind of gets like hit with dust and you see it's got like the predator shimmer kind of thing going, and I'm like, oh my god, it's an invisible like that's kind of brilliant. I don't know if they said we ran out of money, this computer model is just too bad and janky,
right?
Or like, here's our idea, this is what we do. I hope it's part three. That is, to me, I hope what the result is. I'm not positive because we do see some of the scorpion model again. And I'm like, oh, I just don't think that that thing was finished.
Absolutely. Because he defeats the scorpion by covering it in oil. And then now he can see it and he manages to spear it.
But we can only see parts of it. We never see the full thing. So it looks like they never finished the model.
It looks real bad.
It looks like PlayStation 1.
I liked it more when it was invisible, because at least that was limited digital effects, and like that was kind of rad.
Because I can get behind an invisible enemy at the end of a movie. They wasted their idea. They wasted their workaround in that way. You know, he only should have reappeared as Sargon. Otherwise, just build a papier-mâché claw or something. We didn't need the whole thing like they did with the Minotaurs. That was truly unexpected, Dan. That was like a coup de grace, you know? That just put the knife right through me at the end of this, and I was done.
Is this the latest installment of the Invisible Man franchise? You know, we try film noir. Ooh. Horror film noir. Now we've got invisible scorpions. The Invisible Scorpion King is the next one.
Wild stuff.
So yeah, all that's happening while Layla and Fong, obviously, they stop the fire from spreading and destroying the water supply.
They do that crazy dance to kick up the sand so it doesn't get on the wall.
It was right to intercut that with all of the scorpion action and the fight scenes.
At one point, it's just raining, and you're never going to fill up the Colosseum like a pool or anything. It's not going to be like the end of the last Batman movie where they're like swimming in it. Interesting choices.
They save the day there, and the sort of final button on this fight sequence is that Astarte shows up again and basically lets Matthias know that they will meet again.
Yeah, I'll be waiting.
She will show him no mercy. He knows that one day he's going to die and she will have him.
Even before that, he knows that inside every hero lies the potential for a monster.
That's right.
Okay, and she's probably like, hey, he's going to become a big giant scorpion monster one day. I'll have my revenge. I just have to wait. I'm 1,000 years old already.
The next morning, Matthias wakes up in bed next to Layla, who informs him that he has now won the right to be the Scorpion King.
That is a tale for another time.
Yes, he heads off for a life of adventure, knowing that that is what lies ahead of him.
We know he's not immediately going to be Scorpion King, because
we saw the next movie.
Also, if he's hearing that at what, like 18, 19, 20 years old, why does it feel like a surprise to The Rock?
He was doing so much adventuring. He was out doing, and the rest of the world, he totally forgot about this. He forgot about Ari. Like, he forgot he even went to the underworld. He doesn't remember battling an invisible scorpion.
I know that it's a prequel and they want to tell the beginning of Matthias, but how do you cram all this scorpion stuff into his origin? And then in the first Scorpion King movie, it's like this thing that just sort of happens to him by accident, which like it does here. It's the same moment.
It's funny too, then, because at one point towards the end, they're like, and he will have the blood of the scorpion flowing through him. But I was like, wait, isn't that where I was wrong in the first movie where like he didn't have the blood of the scorpion already in him? Like he just got shot with a scorpion blood tipped arrow, and that's what she was talking about, and I was the one that was confused. But here it sounds like I was right, and they're like, no, it's a destiny. And then The Rock shows up and he's like, what's a Scorpion King?
This is maybe the most egregious part of it, is that they literally end the movie on the same beat as the first Scorpion King, where he beats the Scorpion King and then becomes the new Scorpion King.
Look, if that's how they're all going to end, I'm here for that. Like, it would be so funny if the next one is a sequel to this, not the one with The Rock. Like, Ari shows back up.
I do know that the third movie, and I believe the fourth, because they have the same Matthias.
Oh, okay. So they're connected.
I think they're consistently sequels to the original Scorpion King. So they will be going forward, proper sequels. Okay. If you haven't looked into them yet, I would encourage you to not, because the casts are really cool. I would encourage you to wait, because I do know a little bit, and the casts in them are incredible.
Oh, cool. Because that's the one thing this is lacking. Like, anybody that I recognize. Well, I recognize the dude from Westworld, but it's not like the same thing, you know? And it's like, Randy Couture, fine, but it's not like Stone Cold played that role. Then I'd be like, oh, now this is inspired.
Right.
Stone Cold was like, where's that candy ass with my sword of Damocles, damn it.
The Scorpion Kings 3, 4, and the fifth one may not be great movies, but I am very excited just based on the cast, because they are loaded with people that we recognize and enjoy. So,
and I'm looking forward to them, because this wasn't nearly as hard as I thought it was going to be. To watch, to talk about, it was certainly a lot of fun. What's kind of interesting about something like tonight is like, we've got all these different opinions about all these different parts of it. It's like, well, this part wasn't good, but that part was good. And this thing was that interesting, but this wasn't. It felt like we had more to talk about than I was definitely expecting.
We have done quite a few movies where they're huge, right? And what can we say about them that hasn't already been said? Or, you know, I feel a certain amount of pressure to do a really good episode to live up to the status of that movie, especially with these Scorpion King movies. Not that I'm ever phoning it in, but I do feel a lack of pressure to live up to a certain expectation, which is really nice. So in a lot of ways, when we talk about like the big stuff, I look forward to these, because I'm like, oh, this is just going to be a loose, fun, maybe surprising episode. And I hope our listeners are listening too. I don't expect these to be the most popular episodes, but it's a good time.
It is a good time. And it's also sort of within the tradition of the old Universal movies too. There were a lot of questionable sequels to some of those movies as well,
100%.
You know, and we watched those, and we found a lot of fun stuff to talk about with those movies. So this was worth a gamble, as far as I'm concerned, whether we were deciding to program these shows or not. And I think we made the right decision, because if this one was this much fun to discuss, like, the next ones are definitely going to be worthwhile to some degree.
Yeah, 100%. Looking forward to it. Well, I think that about does it for this episode. But before we go, we do have some monster mail. We have quite a bit of monster mail, Mike.
Oh, okay.
I've got three emails, so let's start. First one is from listener Andrew Hinkbein. I hope I said that correctly. He says, hey, I'm an avid listener of your all's and really love the podcast. Or, I recently started a quest to find albums that sync up with the Universal monster movies. After a few failed attempts with Dracula, I hit some gold with Frankenstein and Dark Side of the Moon. Classic album for movie pairing. I figured you guys would get a kick out of this new way to enjoy the movie. Keep up the fantastic podcast, and thank you for all your work you put into it. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, I used to love in high school just turning off the volume of my TV, watching a movie, and putting on a record or something and seeing if it would sync up or not.
Yeah.
There's like a phenomenon that happens some of the times where it's just a matter of like the rhythm, I guess, of the music and the editing and stuff, that like a lot of stuff syncs up in your mind when you do that kind of thing.
thing.
Right.
It's cool to know that people are doing that with the Universal movies too.
Hell yeah. I wasn't aware that there was any album to pair with a Universal monster movie until now, but I'm glad to know that Dark Side of the Moon is a candidate for Frankenstein.
Yeah. The only one I knew was Swan Lake for Dracula. That's what they used in the original Dracula. It syncs up perfectly.
So our next email is from Zach Denny. Zach says, "Hello, Dan and Mike. I wanted to drop you a line of fan mail. I'm a big fan of the podcast. The Universal monster movies are something I grew up on and played a large part in shaping me and my interests. My dad and I still watch them together from time to time. He's the one who exposed me to the movies as a kid. I love being able to hear you both essentially writing a fan letter to my favorite things. When I need something pleasant to listen to, your podcast is a great place to camp out. As many diehard horror fans as there are out there, I find so few podcasts and content focuses on the originals. And for that, I truly thank y'all. I am a host on a podcast myself. Steel Fagnolias is the name if you're into four queer men talking about random topics and cocktail recipes."
Okay, let me just interrupt here quickly, but like for a straight white cis male,
yes,
over here, Steel Magnolias has for some reason always been a comfort film for me. Ever since I was a little kid, there's just something about that movie I love that movie. So you guys might be surprised. I might be tuning in sooner than later.
Just so our listeners know, I did ask Zach for permission to say the name of the podcast. I thought, I really want to promote this show, but there's no way for me as a straight white cis man to do it without saying the name of the show. So yeah, he was very, very gracious to say it was totally cool. So if you want to listen to that, again, the name of the podcast is Steel Fagnolias. You can find it on all the major platforms from what I could tell. I listened to a little bit of it myself and it is fun. He says, "I sneak in stuff about monster movies any chance I get. I did listen to this episode." He says, "I got to do a whole segment on the Universal monster movies on one of our episodes, and it warms my spooky heart to know that maybe someone else will hear that episode and feel seen like I have with listening to you two talk about my favorite niche interest. I was super pumped when I saw y'all covering Van Helsing. That is unironically my favorite movie of all time. I was in fourth grade when it came out and became absolutely obsessed to the point where I even had the action figures and stuff. Still have them in storage.
Sweet.
It's definitely not a perfect movie, but I enjoy the love letter that Stephen Sommers writes about the classics."
Dude, if I had seen that movie at that age, it would definitely hold a much warmer place in my heart. Like, I was a cynical teenager when
yes.
that movie came out, you know? But like,
he says, "It's just so much fun for me. I think the thing that turns a lot of viewers off is just how self-indulgent it can be, which is part of what I love. To me, it felt like childhood play fantasies come to life. Who doesn't want insane acrobatics and beautiful women who can fly? I could tell you two enjoyed it for what it was, flaws and all. I was hoping for a sequel growing up, but the perspective of adulthood and capitalistic gain has shown me that my dreams will probably never come to fruition on that."
Dark Universe revive, never say never. That's what I've learned.
That's entirely true. "I always had a theory slash hope that Van Helsing would go after the Creature from the Black Lagoon and maybe the Invisible Man next with Anna acting as a guide from the clouds. Remember, I was a kid. Plot mapping wasn't my strongest skill. Hey, I think anything's valid at this point. We just watched a movie with an invisible scorpion monster, so I don't think anything's off the table."
Exactly. And now I'm wondering if they had plans to bring a Van Helsing into the Dark Universe and who that was going to be.
He says, "Anyway, I'm rambling. It's a fun romp, and I always try to get people to watch it and tell them to not think too hard and to just enjoy the ride because it'll hurt your brain if you try to unravel it. Thank you both again for covering it and giving it a solid assessment. Side note, I played and still own the video game and it was surprisingly tough. This episode is making me want to go dust off my PS2 and see if I could manage any better than when I played it as a kid. Even though there's still so much ground to cover with the original Universal Monster canon, are y'all considering branching off from there to media that contains those characters? I figured since Van Helsing came up that perhaps y'all might be cooking up the Monster Squad since it has so many of the OG monsters appearing, perhaps even stuff as far-fetched as, say, Alvin and the Chipmunks meet the Wolfman. I also wondered if y'all had any thoughts about diving into other adaptations of the work, such as the 8 million Dracula and Frankenstein adaptations. Whichever direction y'all go, I plan to be tuning in regularly and hope it brings you both joy. Spookily, Zach."
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Zach. First, I just want to say thank you for that email. It was amazing. I appreciate you listening. Thank you for all the kind words. That's awesome. And just as far as I'm concerned regarding the games and stuff, I wish we had time to just do like Monsters That Made Us video game version, like, right, as well. Even if I just watch the walkthroughs on YouTube or whatever, or get to play them, like, I am just so fascinated by video games that are based off of not just like I love video games, but like the older, like 8 and 16 bit generations, so many games based on movies that were so weird in the PlayStation era. So that's great that you had the Van Helsing PlayStation 2 video game. I'm sorry I missed that.
To answer your other questions, I think we can sort of answer everything in one. Yeah, I don't think there's any limit to the episodes or the content we could put out, as long as the Frankenstein monsters involved, or the Wolfman, or the Invisible Man. You know, as long as these characters are there, I think anything remains possible. Even video games, Mike. I mean, it's not going to be a high priority for us at the moment. We still have so many things we have to get through. But we were just on a live stream on YouTube, and we were talking about how we could do this show forever and just talk about these characters, right? Like, there's so many other horror movies that we love, but if we only ever stay talking about these characters or other versions of these characters, like, we want to talk about Hammer films and maybe go back and maybe do the other Universal horrors from the 30s and 40s too. That's a possibility. But yeah, I mean, like, we're sticking with Universal for now. And once we get out of that, then that frees us up to look around and look at other versions. We definitely want to talk about Hammer. We want to talk about the Coppola Dracula movie from the 90s. And like, there's so many other things. Monster Squad would definitely be something we would want to talk about. It'll take some time, and we only release once a month, but nothing is off the table as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly.
So we have one more email. This one comes from Chris Necht. Hope I said that correctly. He says, "Hey, Dan and Mike, I felt it was time to send you both a message to tell you how much I have enjoyed your podcast."
Phew. I thought it was going to go the other way around for a second there. You never know.
You never know. Hey, I'll read hate mail on this show. I don't care.
We'll read anything you send us. The Gettysburg Address, as long as it's addressed to us.
"Because of the monsters that made us, I bought myself the Universal Monsters 30 film collection and have watched all of them.
All right.
As a longtime horror movie fan, it was a blast to explore these films and then be able to learn more from each corresponding episode. Without a doubt, my favorite discovery was Creature from the Black Lagoon. I absolutely loved it, and now I have the Gillman staring at me from the many posters I have plastered on my walls. I also had a great time asking the two of you questions on the live YouTube show that you both did recently. Speaking please consider doing that again on your own channel from time to time. Actually, Chris, Mike and I have discussed that."
Yeah, funny you should say that.
"We really enjoyed that experience, and we would love to find ways to do more of that. You know, the only downside to the live stream is that it's sort of limits us to YouTube to host that particular content, right? So if we record something as a podcast, we can release it on iTunes, we can release it on, you know, so many other podcasting platforms. So I'm not sure what we want to do with YouTube live streams, but we definitely want to do more of that, because getting to interact with listeners in real time and answer your questions as they came was really a good time. We've definitely been talking about it and just want to figure out what specifically we want to do." So he says, "I look forward to your show every month, and I hope the show keeps growing and reaching more people. I did want to ask you both a question. Which of the two classic monsters would you want to see battle it out head to head in a movie, and who would you bet on to win? Thanks, Chris from San Diego."
Wow. Well, a couple of them have already fought each other back in the day, right? Like, that's, we had the Wolfman fought Frankenstein. That was a good battle.
Yep.
For me, one of them's got to be the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yep.
He's slippery. He's hard to hold on to. He'd be a good fighter. He's got the water element as well. He could lure you into there. But who would he fight? Maybe a vampire? That would be really interesting to see what would happen between the two of those guys.
That would be cool, because Dracula, I don't know how he would fare in water. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and what if Dracula like grabbed the creature and like flew him into the sky?
Sure.
Would he like freeze in the atmosphere up there, the stratosphere?
He would definitely have to take the fight to the creature, because he's cool chilling in his lagoon, right? So as long as he's got a body of water, there's no reason for him to ever have to come out.
Well, that's the thing. You have to pick the fight with him. That would be Dracula's expanding his domain. Yes. He goes down to Florida or wherever the creature was, and he accidentally enters the wrong lagoon, you know, run by the wrong dude. And it's like, sorry, pal, like, this place is taken.
I've got some choices. You know, obviously we've seen Dracula, the Frankenstein monster, and the Wolfman do battle multiple times, right? I'm surprised we never saw the Mummy in there. But I think the two that I would be really interested to see is the Invisible Man.
Oh, okay.
Fight the Phantom of the Opera.
All right.
They are two men, you know, they're not supernatural creatures. They're both just megalomaniacal men. You know, the Invisible Man, obviously invisible, but the Phantom of the Opera is very comfortable in darkness. So I think he would find a way to level the playing field by taking that fight into the darkness, you know?
Yeah, that's a great idea. I love that. And that's exactly how that fight would go down, because the Invisible Man would have the upper hand, yep, right? Because you can't see him. But then the Phantom's going to turn the lights out. You can't see him, but he's going to be able to sense you better because, yeah, he creeps around under the opera house and in those all those dark alleys. I was almost going to say the Phantom and Igor, but Igor is a little more supernatural. He's been killed a couple times.
He's had his brain transplanted into a Frankenstein.
Yeah, too late for that now. But I like that idea between the Phantom and the Invisible Man.
I don't know who I would bet on to win. Do you think the Phantom's got it?
I think it's going to go down like that. Like, I think the thing is, you know, Griffin's going to be like, ha ha, I can see you, but you can't see me. I've got the upper hand. And then the Phantom's going to be like, well, we can't see each other, so it's level. And then he's got his Phantom senses because he's honed them.
And he knows the layout of the opera really well. So yeah, I might be with you. I think the Phantom might have the edge there, but it would be really fun to watch, I think. Maybe not as an audience member, because they're in the dark or invisible.
It would be cool to get like the recount of that, right? Like, may not be the most visual thing,
right?
Two guys fighting in the dark. But I'd like to read what they were thinking as it was happening.
That might be a good fanfic.
Dude, now that I think about it, Dan, it's hilarious. Just like the climax is two guys fighting in a dark room and like the audience can't see anything. It's just all Foley work. But like the movie comes out in 2024 and like that's what you're getting.
There are some madmen out there who could find a way to make that entertaining. I have no doubt. Okay, so that's the end of our mail segment. That was super fun. Right. Thank you to everyone who wrote us emails. If you would like to write us an email, reach us at themonstersthatmadeus@gmail.com. Like I said, we will read pretty much anything. We've only ever received really great emails, and we're so grateful for that. So yeah, keep them coming. We will be back on Friday, May 31st to discuss 2010's The Wolfman, starring Benicio Del Toro, Anthony Hopkins, Emily Blunt, and Hugo Weaving.
I'm so excited.
Talk about it in that episode, but I remember seeing that in the theater. I went with my grandmother, of all people.
Oh, wow. I can't wait to
hear that. My grandmother grew up watching The Wolfman at the movies and wanted to go see this new one. And so that's what I saw with my grandmother. It was a good experience. Yeah, look forward to that. That'll be coming out at the end of May. You can follow us in the meantime on X, aka Twitter, at Monster Made Pod. We're also on Blue Sky at Monster Made Pod, and on Instagram and Facebook at The Monsters That Made Us. You can follow me pretty much everywhere at Dan Cologne. Mike, where can listeners find you?
You can also follow me pretty much everywhere at @_Mikester, MIKESTIR, and all the other shows that I am on at cageclub.me.
If you enjoyed this episode and you want to support the show, you can become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/themonstersthatmadeus. Any of the money we get from our Patreon immediately goes right back into the show so that we can continue bringing you more of this cool stuff. And we've got some stuff that we really want to do, so keep joining the Patreon. We appreciate every dollar we get there. You can also support the show by giving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. And we can't forget about our t-shirts on TeePublic. You can find the link for that in our aforementioned Twitter and Instagram bios. For all other things Cage Club related, just head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. Stay spooky, everybody.